ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of the Politics Now podcast. And navigating what our rapidly changing world means can be tricky.
I do think you're right to point to the ability of the backbench in Britain to agitate, be upset with Keir Starmer. That's one of the reasons he's gone.
That's why I'm joined by the sharpest political minds at the ABC to break down what each development means for Australia and how the government is positioning.
Albanese's got a much more compliant backbench and he's got much more dominance of the Parliament just because of peculiar Australian features of our system.
That's Politics Now with me, Patricia Carvelis. Find it on ABC Listen.
At some point, the leaders of the world will need to get together and discuss how to use artificial intelligence in a way that doesn't destroy humankind.
Is AI that significant in your mind?
The actual artificial intelligence itself is like regulating a plume of smoke. And I'm not sure that that is something that is possible.
How does your party get back in step with Australians?
We have the same structure today in the Liberal Party that we had in 1944. It's clearly not fit for purpose. It's very, very clunky and it doesn't work.
What do you make then of some of the interventions from Tony Abbott in his new role?
Well, that's a matter for Tony. I'm not getting into a public debate with Tony Abbott. Those days are well and truly over.
Artificial intelligence was the big story of the week out of Canberra, with the Prime Minister announcing he'll legislate guardrails for investment in data centres and ensure that artists retain control of their work, with the details yet to come. But investment dollars and the ability to help shape AI policy in some way aren't the only benefits to the AI boom that the government is highlighting. National security and sovereignty are also being pointed to as some of the drivers of the government's thinking. I'm keen to explore this and more on the pod today. I'm David Lipson on Ngunnawal Country at Parliament House. This is Insiders on Background. Christopher Pyne is a stalwart of the Liberal Party and a former defence minister. He now runs a consultancy firm which has a number of defence contractors as clients, and he joins me now from Adelaide. Great to speak to you again, Christopher.
David, nice to be with you too.
Well, former Home Affairs Secretary Mike Pezzullo has pointed to comments from Vladimir Putin a decade ago where he said that the country that leads in AI will be the ruler of the world. Is that the way you see it?
Well, absolutely it is. And I think Mike Pezzullo is right to point to those comments of Vladimir Putin. I think the artificial intelligence genie is well and truly out of the bottle. I tend to be in the Henry Kissinger school, David, which is that human beings have ruled the earth for tens of thousands of years because they're the most intelligent being on the earth and they were able to outsmart all the others. And of course, now that we've created something that will be more intelligent than human beings, it's only a matter of time. I'm not saying in the next 10 years, but in thousands of years from now, I'm not sure that artificial intelligence will see much use for human beings. Human beings are very costly to keep. We have to be fed and entertained and watered and housed. And at some point in time, the manufactured creatures that are artificial intelligence will almost certainly decide that human beings are a rather costly, illogical organism. But that's a bit doomsday. It is a bit doomsday. I'll be well and truly gone by then, but I'm talking a long way in the future.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's a long way in the future.
Definitely.
Exactly. What about in the near future, you know, a decade away or years away or even now? You know, how is it playing out? Because we are seeing autonomous machines. I'm interested in your thoughts on how big a role it's going to play in our future.
Well, I think it's the most significant development since the invention of the nuclear weapon. Artificial intelligence has the capacity to, as Vladimir Putin points out, give its controller, if there is such a thing, ultimate power. I don't think anybody realises this yet. I think right now it's seen as a useful tool, sometimes a game to be played with. But from a military point of view, from a national security point of view, artificial intelligence gives its handler ultimate power. But I think most nations of the world realise that, and I'm not doomsday about that kind of power. I do feel that China, United States, to a lesser extent, countries like Russia, which is not actually a significant military power. Let's face it, if Russia was a significant military power, it would have conquered the Ukraine several years ago. It can't even manage to do that. So I don't think we should be too afeard of Russia as a military power. But there are others that are trying to become military powers and have significant capability. But at some point, the leaders of the world will need to get together and discuss how to use artificial intelligence in a way that doesn't destroy humankind. I'm sort of interested in Anthony Albanese's announcements about regulating AI. I can certainly see how you can regulate data centers and the use of water and energy and where they'll be, but the actual artificial intelligence itself is like regulating a plume of smoke, and I'm not sure that that is something that is possible. Many times over human history, people have just said...
You don't think there's any way to sort of help shape the algorithm if we're at least involved in the building of these centres and have them on our sovereign land?
No, well, I don't, actually. I don't think so. I think people who are behind AI in the United States or Australia or China or Japan or Switzerland or wherever they might be would be kind of slightly bemused at the idea that you can regulate and control artificial intelligence. Even the inventors of artificial intelligence have said that that horse is well and truly bolted. And some of them are regretting it and saying that they're sorry that they let that happen. But once it's done, it's done. The internet, email, mobile phones that really are more of a tool. But artificial intelligence is not something that has boundaries. I don't know how you now put guardrails around something that doesn't recognise boundaries. But I do admire the fact that the government is recognising that there's a potential problem. I can see that Anthony, through things like copyright law, believes that they'll be able to protect the rights of artists. I hope so. But I think it very much remains to be seen. And I think the world is a very different place today because of artificial intelligence. And that's going to continue very quickly. The Industrial Revolution will seem like a slow-moving train in comparison to what artificial intelligence will bring about on the globe.
So overall, a positive thing to embrace the construction of data centres with regulation here in this country, in your mind?
Well, they're kind of two different things, David. Regulating the creation of data centres is really planning law, water law, energy law. It's got nothing to do with regulating artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is something that I don't think is regulatable. From a national security point of view, there needs to be the major nations of the world militarily get together and say, now, what are we going to use this for or not? Which they do today in discussions about intelligence sharing and avoiding World War III, which is sensible and intelligent. But what the Prime Minister announced this week is not regulating artificial intelligence. It's more about trying to show to the public that he understands their nervousness about unbridled, uncontrolled building of data centres, using of energy, soaking up of water, all of which we say is in short supply.
Just bringing you back to defence, national security, do you think as a nation we are investing enough in the sphere of AI? Especially when you consider how much we're spending on huge projects, more conventional defence projects like AUKUS.
Well, of course, in AUKUS, Pillar 2 of AUKUS, which is not talked about nearly as much as the submarine part of AUKUS, which is Pillar 1, one of the subjects of Pillar 2 is actually artificial intelligence and quantum computing. And Australia is a world leader in quantum computing. At the University of New South Wales, Michelle Simmons, who leads the school in quantum computing, they are world leaders. They're probably a year ahead of anybody else. The whole world looks to Australia for quantum computing. It's one of the reasons the United States wanted to do AUKUS, because we have really significant capabilities in quantum computing and in artificial intelligence. So, yes, I think Australia can definitely play a role in artificial intelligence and using it for good, as we already are in quantum computing, and we have significant capabilities. Not very well understood, but we've won a lot of Nobel Prizes in areas like chemistry and physics, mathematics, obviously, and medicine. because we are very smart. So, yes, we can definitely play a role, and we are. And it's being done through AUKUS, AUKUS Pillar 2.
Is it enough of investment, and are we investing enough, focusing enough on Pillar 2?
Well, do we ever invest enough in anything to do with things like, you know, new inventions? I think the answer to that would be depends who you are. I mean, if you're a if you're a research scientist at the University of Adelaide, you think that we should be doing more on artificial intelligence. But, you know, if you're getting the sandwiches together for the morning run, you think, well, I haven't got time to think about that. So, yes, I mean, everyone has different priorities, don't they? But do I think we should be putting more money into in research in artificial intelligence and quantum computing and hypersonics and unmanned vessels? Yes, definitely. But there's only so much money in the pot, and we're already spending $360 billion plus on AUKUS. I'm not sure there's much stomach in the Australian public for announcing new spending as part of the AUKUS program. Mm.
And indeed, you appeared this week before the Peter Garrett-led crowd-funded inquiry on AUKUS, where you predicted that even that eye-watering price tag wouldn't be sort of met on budget. Can you explain a little bit more about that? How much you expect it to blow out, and I guess why you appeared in that inquiry when you seemed pretty sceptical about it?
Well, I appeared in the inquiry because I knew it'd be a bunch of lefties all sitting around bashing the United States, which of course is the progenitor of the inquiry, and I'm absolutely certain we already know what their outcomes are going to be, which is that AUKUS is no good, the US is no good, Donald Trump's no good, and we should all get out of it. But I also believe in the battle of ideas and the discourse of public debate, and I thought, well, they're in my city, I have strong views about AUKUS and national security. If I don't appear, I can't really criticise from the outside. I hate people that do that. So I should turn up and put my view, and they were very polite, and I was very polite. Obviously, old friends, Peter Garrett, Carmen Lawrence, people I've known for a long time, and it was a very happy conversation. But I'm sure they didn't agree with anything I said. But it's very important to have these debates. And I always used to say when I was the Minister for Defence, the problem with national security debates in Australia is that we don't actually explain to the Australian public how important these things are. And what I said about the timetable and the budget for AUKUS was that that's not the priority. Sure, we'd love it to be on time. Obviously, we'd like it to be on budget. But it's not actually the priority. The priority is delivering the most lethal submarine capability in the Indo-Pacific to the Australian Navy to keep the peace in the Indo-Pacific and protect Australia's national interests. That's the priority, and that will happen. Whether it takes a bit longer or costs a bit more, I didn't say that wasn't important. I just said it wasn't as important as delivering the capability. And by the way, put it around the other way, David. If it's not on time and it's not on budget, are we going to send it back? It's not like a Bunnings gardening system that you put in over the weekend that doesn't work and you go and get another one. The answer is obviously not. So the priority is the national security interest, and that will be met by both Pillar 1, the submarines, and Pillar 2, which are the six different subjects upon which Pillar 2 rests, which are all very important, and Australia has capability in all of them.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of Canberra insiders see the benefits of AUKUS, and a lot of Australians outside of Canberra too. But there's, you'd have to agree, a whole lot of scepticism more broadly in the public about such a huge sum of money. Can you just explain the scenario in your mind, particularly the more expensive elements of AUKUS, the nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, I should say, the scenario in your head that justifies such a big spend for getting these subs rather than the more conventional subs that we've had in the past?
Well, I think the easiest way to describe that to the Australian public is that if there was a war in the Indo-Pacific, no enemy surface vessel will leave port if they do not know where the Australian submarines are, because the submarines are the most lethal weapon of the sea, probably one of the most lethal weapons of all time. And that will defend Australia in a situation where we are facing a conflagration in our region. We are an island. The only way we can be conquered is by people landing here with soldiers and taking over our country. It can't be bombed into submission, as we're seeing with Iran right now. The only way we can be conquered is if an enemy can get to shore. And so submarines will stop that happening, because the enemy will not risk trying to get to Australia if they don't know where those eight submarines, which is the number in total eventually, are placed. That's why the six Collins-class submarines are so important. And when the public realises that that gives us an edge over our opponent, they often say, wow, we didn't realise that. Because if you think about it, if you can't see the submarine, and because it's very stealthy, and nuclear submarines are very stealthy and never have to surface, the only reason they surface is so the sailors can get supplies to eat and drink. They could stay underwater for 34 years, David, if there was no human being on board. So the enemy will not leave their shipyards, their bases, because they'll be frightened of being taken out by a submarine. And a submarine could take out half a dozen surface ships in one go before they even were scratched. So they're very, very powerful, lethal weapon. That's why we're spending $368 billion on them.
I don't think submarines have a handbrake, but I'm going to do a bit of a handbrake turn here on the podcast, because I do want to get your thoughts on One Nation. This week, we've seen a number of controversies involving Pauline Hanson, Malcolm Roberts, Gina Reinhart's been in there as well. And we've seen some movement in the polls, probably not enough to describe it as a trend yet, but some of the enemies of One Nation are hopeful, you could say, that they might have hit their ceiling. But I'm interested in your thoughts more broadly on not just this week, the bigger picture of One Nation, the state of play for politics, and particularly the Liberal Party.
Well, I guess the irony for One Nation, David, is that obviously Pauline Hanson is anti-Labor and says quite rightly from her point of view that the Labor government is the enemy and needs to be removed. I get that. I'm a Liberal, obviously. I want the Liberal Party to win elections too. But will One Nation stop Labor being removed because people who otherwise would have voted for Angus Taylor and the Liberal team don't do so because they're frightened of One Nation being in a coalition government? So I think, sure, there's the ups and downs of controversies, and we'll see plenty of those between now and the next election. But the broader point is, let's take the Victorian election, which is the next test. Jess Wilson, very popular. A lot of people can see her as the Premier of Victoria. Jacinta Allen leads a government that's been in power for, by then, a dozen years. A lot of people think the Victorian government needs to be replaced, needs to be refreshed, regardless of their political persuasion. But will people hesitate to vote for Jess Wilson and the Liberal Party because they're frightened of One Nation being in government in a coalition? Now, if Labor can make that stick, and if it's enough of a hesitation, well, ironically, because of One Nation's rise, they could keep Labor in power, because people in the centre-right or the centre won't vote for Liberals because they're frightened One Nation will form a government. So that to me is an interesting dilemma, and how to resolve it is hard. So when One Nation goes down in the polls, which I think it will do so a bit, and if the Liberals go up in the polls, that actually makes the chances of Labor being replaced higher. But if One Nation is seen to be the primary opposition party, I think we'll see a Labor hegemony in this country, similar to the Nordic countries in Europe, which will go on for a very long time because voters will hesitate to vote for One Nation. Now, maybe I'm wrong. That's my analysis. It's not much talked about in the political world. We seem to talk about what happened today or this evening, as opposed to the broader context. But I think that is a very significant problem that the Liberal Party, I'm sure, is turning its mind to, because it could keep them out of office if they're seen to be too close to One Nation. But on the other hand, if there aren't enough seats to form for Labor to form a government, will the Liberal Party form a coalition with One Nation and the Nationals? And would that therefore stop them winning in the first place because people won't vote for them? It's kind of slightly complicated, but it's an easy analysis to make out.
Mm. So does that mean, in your mind, talk about preference swaps with One Nation, coalitions with One Nation, and I guess also in some sense imitating the policies of one nation on everything across the board in politics, multiculturalism is one that comes to mind, that kind of strategy is a bad one for the Liberals?
Well, it's fatal. If the Liberal Party continues, or some people in it, continue to talk about preference deals and coalitions and being closer to one nation and emulating their policies or saying that they're the future, that's fatal to the Liberal Party's chances of forming a government and will keep Labor in power. Because that's exactly why people in the centre of the political spectrum, where most Australians describe themselves as being, by the way, what the Liberal Party needs to do is get the debate back onto the things that make the Liberal Party one of the most successful parties of government since the Second World War. The economy, low interest rates, lower taxes, smaller government, staying out of people's private lives, individual freedom. And if they can keep doing that, and I think Angus Taylor and Tim Wilson and their team have kind of found their line of length on the economy since the budget, well, you'll continue to see a rise in the Liberal Party standing and One Nation will be dropping in the polls. But if they instead think the answer is to chase One Nation, well, then Labor will be in power for the rest of my lifetime.
Yeah. What do you make then of some of the interventions from Tony Abbott in his new role in the administrative wing of the party? Are they helpful?
Look, it's not my business to comment on the administrative wing of the Liberal Party. I'm simply a branch member.
But I mean, he's more than an administrator, right? He's making very public comments about immigration, about some of the things that you're saying the party should steer away from.
Well, that's a matter for Tony. I'm not a matter for me. I'm not getting into a public debate with Tony Abbott. Those days are well and truly over. I'm a happy citizen now.
Good for you. And just your thoughts on this discussion paper on the direction of the Liberal Party, which describes it as out of step with modern and diverse Australia. I mean, I think that's part of what you're talking about here. How does your party get back in step with Australians?
Yes, it's very important for the Liberal Party to decide what it looks like into the future. We have the same structure today in the Liberal Party that we had in 1944. It's clearly not fit for purpose. From a pre-selection point of view, from electing state executives and federal executives, electing state presidents, running head offices and campaign units, it's very, very clunky. It's a federation and it doesn't work. And look, it worked when Labor was unelectable, which it's been for a long time until the Hawke-Keating period, which now it's much more competitive, and they have a much more modern structure. So I'm glad that James McGrath's doing that work with his team, and I wish them the best of luck. But we do need root and branch change in the Liberal Party. But the most important thing we need in the Liberal Party is an influx of members from across the diverse range of the Australian population. We are very top-heavy with older people, with Anglo-Celtic background people, of which I'm one, and we need a significant injection of fresh blood.
Very interesting, Christopher Pyne. Wonderful to get your insights on that and all the other topics we discussed. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure, David. Nice to see you again.
And thanks for your company as well. Be sure to tune in on Sunday. Patricia Karvelas will be speaking with the Shadow Housing Minister, Andrew Bragg, on Insiders, 9 a.m. on ABC TV and iView. And PK will be back in the Politics Now feed from Monday. The Insiders on Background Pod will return at the end of the week. See you next time.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.